This episode of Script to Screen is powered by Speedy Comics.
You can follow them on Instagram on Speedy Comics ME and on their website, speedycomicsme.com.
Hi guys, I'm Ruth Jung.
Hello, my name is Joseph David Jones.
Hey, this is Kevin Sussman.
Hey, this is Mina Massoud.
I'm John Reese Davis, and you're listening to Script to Screen.
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 Hello, screeners. Alan here. As we, and by we, I mean Hod and I, continue to restructure and update Script to Screen for its brand new season, we didn't want to leave this feed empty. Now, I know we have a lot of stuff coming for the rest of this season before the brand new season begins, including the episode-by-episode breakdown of The Mandalorian with a close friend of the pod and I. We wanted to ensure that this week you guys had something to listen to. So, at one point, I did have a podcast by the name of Creatively Speaking. It was very much short-lived. It was kind of like a small little thing that I tried to do, but it didn't work out the way I wanted to. But I did have some really cool conversations with some very talented people, including some lovers of film and people within the industry. So, I wanted to repurpose those conversations that I had with these people onto Script to Screen. Today's episode is actually a conversation that I had with one of the writers of Amazon Prime's Carnival Row. Yes, I had a conversation with one of the writers of that show. I was a big fan of the show when it was on. I literally binged it in a matter of a couple of days. It was fantastic. I'm a lover of fantasy, and to see fantasy or the fantasy genre being infused within the industrial kind of time period was very, very much a joy to watch. Not to mention that the show itself is pretty, pretty darn good. So I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with writer Stephanie K. Smith. And we'll see you guys very, very soon. Enjoy.
You're alive.
You left me in the ashes of my homeland.
This is where we come alive.
Killer's still out there.
She was taken by something unnatural. Neither man nor fae.
She loves you and is going to get her killed.
They don't know the truth about you.
A man's no better than the pain he's caused the people he loves and what he's willing to do to set it right.
I don't know if you guys have been around, but if you've, I mean, obviously, if you follow me on social media, you know for a fact that I've been flipping out over a new show that literally premiered at the end of August on Amazon Prime. And literally binged it in 2 days. And I couldn't stop watching it because of how immersive it was, because of the beautiful characters and the world, and what I loved even more about it, that for once we were watching something that was not based on a book or a comic book or any intellectual property out there, aside from the intellectual property that literally existed inside of the great mind of Travis Beecham. And so with me today is one of the writers of Carnival Row, Stephanie. Hello.
Hi there.
So you were one of the writers, obviously.
Yes. Yes, I was.
How many were you
in
that writer's room?
In season one, we were 1, 2, 3, 4 plus the showrunner and Travis. So 6 in total.
6 in total. And I love that you just indirectly like teased season 2. You're like, well, for season 1, we were 6.
Yes.
Are you more for season 2?
Well, let me think. In season 2, we are 1, 2, 6, 7, 8. We wound up with actually 9 people worked on season 2.
Wow, that's so exciting. Okay, but we're not going to talk about season two. We're going to talk about season one.
Yes.
What was that process like for you as a writer? Now, you worked on Genius as well before Carnival Row, correct?
No. Carnival Row, we did season one 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. So, okay. I did not know that. That's cool.
So for me personally, like, I came from the world of development, which is when you sell pilots and, you know, work on those. And so Renee Echevarria, who was our season one showrunner, had just finished being attached to a pilot that I'd written. He had two pilots going at the same time at Legendary, and it was mine and Travis's. And mine didn't go anywhere. And so when Carnival Row was sort of in the process of staffing, I slightly stalked him. I read the feature, and then I was like, oh, okay, well, I need to get a meeting on this. And, you know, Travis's feature from like 2002 or three.
And yeah, I did hear that he actually initially wrote it as a feature, but then it didn't go anywhere as a feature.
Well, it made the first blacklist, and which is like a big screenwriting competition. And so then it sold, and over time there were a million different people attached to it. Like, whoever the trendy director of the day were attached to it briefly, but it never ended up going anywhere. And so at some point, I want to say it was 2015, but it might've been 2016. I think it was 2015. In fact, they decided to do it as a television series. I think it was Legendary who, you know, made that choice. And at that time, Guillermo del Toro was attached to it. And in fact, he was still a part of it.
Oh, that's so interesting. I wonder what that would have been like.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I know a little bit, but he was gone within a week of our writer's room starting. So yeah. So basically, like, I just like stayed on Renee. He introduced me to Travis and I got hired, and I was excited. First of all, the world was so nothing I had ever seen before, which was really exciting.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the other thing, though, and you have to keep in mind, and I don't know how much of this stuff gets around, you know, globally or anything like that, but in 2017, Me Too was a huge thing here. And obviously Trump getting elected was a huge thing here. We were in the room on Carnival Row before either of those things. And so I read the script, and it had vignette was really like intense and tough, and not in a way, in like a Hollywoody way where like she knew kung fu or she could drink guys under the table. You know, it was like she was just someone who had been through something and wanted to find a place that was home. And it wasn't really about a man or any of that sort of stuff. And so even though there was a love story to it too, and so I kind of fell in love with that.
Okay, just to take a little side, take a side path right now, because you mentioned the love stories and then you also mentioned vignette strength. And I kind of do want to talk about those specifically because, like you said, like, they're both very unconventional, like Hollywood stuff, because vignette's strength comes from her spirit and not necessarily from her physicality or anything like that. Like you said, like, it's not like she could do kung fu or kick the living heck out of someone. It was just her like resilience and her belief in, I don't know, like a better tomorrow or whatever, that was her. That's where her strength came from. And it was just very refreshing to see a female character written this way. Because you indirectly, you just want to cheer her on regardless. And you believe everything that she goes through, and it is authentic and it's genuine. And it doesn't feel like, you know, like a, because sometimes female characters come off like their strengths are just written in there and they don't feel genuine. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's to be frank, it's men tacking qualities on because they think that they can't understand women, that women are some sort of foreign creature. But in fact, you know, we're not. We're just human beings. And to actually see like a fully rounded, woman portrayed on screen. And I think they all are that. And to be fair, I mean, look, I don't know. Am I allowed to talk about the entire season? I don't know. I don't know how much I'm allowed.
Yeah. I'll make sure to add a little disclaimer before our interview in the episode to say that this is going to be spoilerish. So, because I'm not going to have you on here and talk to you and not talk about everything. Like, I might as well take advantage of all the you know, the season.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for me, and I just rewatched the back half of the season last night because my husband wanted to watch it. And I think that the strongest characters, to me anyway, that resonate with me the most, but I think also because they're the most complex and most interesting, are Vignette and then Sophie and Imogen. And also Tourmaline, honestly, but like Sophie and Imogen in particular, like watching them. I think it was very important to me in the room at the time, but it's also something that you have to give Travis credit for. And I said this to him early on, and I like to hope this is the next generation that, like, as our generation, I mean, we're obviously doing stuff, but like as it becomes the prevailing group of people that are making stuff and sort of like the older people are gone, that this will be what happens. He just writes women like they're people, and it's refreshing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, as you were listing, I was trying to guess which characters you were going to say. And Tourmaline was on that list for me.
The actress is great.
Oh, she's so good. Oh my gosh. The cast, everybody in the cast, that I just get chills thinking about all of their performances. But what I wanted to say is two things, like on that subject, the complexity of all the characters. And this is what I loved most about the show. If we're sitting here wanting to talk about equality and talking about inclusiveness and all that stuff, the characters, literally every character in that story was equal to the one next to them, just as complex, just as real, yeah, just as authentic. And it just worked so beautifully. Like, if you ask me right now, who's your favorite character? I probably wouldn't be able to tell you, because I'd be like, that's totally unfair, because there's something I love in every single one of the characters, the good characters, the villainous characters. Like, I love all of them. Like, everything.
Oh, I love that.
I can't pick. Like, I literally cannot pick. And Imogen's arc for me is probably the most unique in all of the show. Maybe also Sophie, but like Imogen's character, I literally looked over to my dad, maybe the second episode after she meets,
Agrius.
Shoot. Yeah, Agrius. I looked over to my dad and I was like, you watch, this is going to be a Beauty and the Beast narrative. And he was like, you sure? And I was like, no, trust me. She's going to fall for him, and it's going to be the most amazing revelation in the entirety of her character structure. And it actually happened. And I was so happy that I picked up on it so early on.
Yeah, I wrote 6, the episode where it happens. And yeah, it's absolutely,
well done.
Absolutely my favorite. It's my favorite thing that happens in the show. I love watching them. I think they're both extraordinary actors.
It's so poetic, and the way that it's just shaped. And I think this is another thing. And my dad said this too. He looked at me, he goes, I feel like we're watching modern Shakespeare on screen.
Somebody and I was like, yesterday.
I was like, you are 100% right. This is like our, like 2019's version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Like, this is what it is. It's stunning.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Do you know what's funny about that? Because I do think, you know, it has everything, and it's a lot. And I think that's a lot for some people because there's so much stuff going on. But I think the reason for that is that it is a fully realized world. You know, you talked about that there is no intellectual property, and it's, you know, I do a lot of adaptation from book to screen. And that's one thing when you're a screenwriter and you read a book and you go and you look through and you cull things out because you're just looking for a singular through line. And that's even true with TV, like you're picking plots and you're doing all that stuff. But in this case, we weren't doing that because we were literally, I mean, Travis's brain is the IP, right? He has an entire history that goes beyond any single fictional narrative that could be he can go back 7 centuries and tell you how this world came to be and who was the ruler when and who, how they screwed over whom and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Oh my God. I just want to live in his brain for a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. And, you know, and it's a lot to tap into. And I think that's why there is a lot. But I think there is that is a really nice comparison. But I understand why it's made. And I think it's fair because it has that Shakespearean, like there's highbrow stuff and lowbrow stuff and monsters and, you know, possessions and all different sorts of stuff going on in the same world.
Yeah, absolutely. So since you mentioned the writer's room a little bit, mm-hmm. could we talk about, because again, I find this so unique that it was Travis sitting with you guys and every meeting that you guys had?
Yeah. We went to work every day and he was there. We were a big room.
Okay.
And
was it like you guys spitballing with him or brainstorming with him or did he present you with an arc for season one or?
No. I mean, we knew the world and we knew we knew that there was a dead fairy and that Philo had to find out who did it. And, you know, Philo and Vignette existed. Like by the time I came to the table, there was a pilot. That changed multiple times.
As they usually do.
Yes. But part of what was so difficult for this show and why it's such a miracle that we ended up coming this far, because as I said, it was 3 years ago right now that we were starting that season one writer's room.
Right.
In the interim, there were 3 different regime changes at Amazon.
Oh, and wow.
So,
okay.
And then also 2 at our studio at Legendary. So there were so many different execs that came in and out that so many changes had to be made at different times, you know, because when you're working with different people, they want different things. And yet you've got to stay true to the vision. And, you know, so it's a complicated process. And ours was even more complicated than normal. But I do think it's a testament to the property itself and to Travis's vision and to the world, really, that it withstood all of that and still made it through. I mean, yeah, it's kind of amazing. But yes, we were all in a room and every day we'd go in and we'd break, you know, how is it going to twist and turn and what are going to be the turn, like the mystery and how is this story going to evolve? And I think I'm trying to remember because as I said, it was 3 years ago. I think we did know that Imogen and Agrius would get together. We did know, I'm trying to think of what else did we know? Sophie came out of the room.
Okay.
She didn't exist initially. She came out of the room. I'm trying to think of what else we knew. I mean, it was largely a free fall, but then keeping in mind that it was within the context of you could pitch something and then Travis would be like, no, because you can't go from A to B in this amount of time because it actually takes 6 hours to get there, you know, because he had it so fleshed out in his head.
Okay. See, that's awesome because, okay, so here's another little side story. So one of my friends was asking me about the show. And this friend is like a diehard Game of Thrones fan, right? And so, you know, I was talking to him about it. I was like, you know, I love Game of Thrones. I love seasons 1 through 4, 5 through 8. Had good moments, but not so great moments. And season 8, although in the moment I was a big fan, in hindsight, not so much. And so the fact that Travis is even saying, okay, no, it would take 6 hours to go from here to here is like, okay, so that would have solved 90% of the second half of Game of Thrones, like seasons 5 through 8, because time was thrown out the window.
Oh, yeah.
People would be at King's Landing and then the next scene they're in Winterfell and you're like, wait, what? You know?
Oh, no. We're very specific. I mean, like we had a lot of analysis over that stuff because you'll see in season 2. It's no spoiler to say that Imogen and Agrius are on a boat at the end of the first season, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, So we're going to see more of the world in season two. And we're dealing with time differences because we're jumping back and forth between two different places. And we were like, okay, if it's day there, then it's night here. And is it like London to New York or is it like London to Los Angeles? Like,
oh, that's so amazing. See, that's so amazing. Okay.
That's fun.
No. It's fascinating for me because so I have a master's in screenwriting. So like screenwriting mm-hmm. is something that I've always wanted to do. So hearing you talk about what it's like being inside of a writer's room is like heaven. It's like an extra cherry on top of the already I'm talking to one of the writers of Carnival Row Ice Cream, which is great.
It's the best job you could ask for. I mean, it can be awful and it can be a nightmare, but every once in a while you have to, like, even if you're in a bad circumstance, you have to go, hang on a second. I get paid to sit around and like make up stories. Like, this is pretty great. This is what I thought about when I was a little kid, you know? So, yeah.
Okay. So aside from like Sophie coming out of the room, which is very interesting because I would have thought that Sophie was kind of like in the core mm-hmm. of the storyline because that's what she appears to be at the end.
Sophie initially appeared in episode 6. And then I don't know how much of the production history of, you know, of this, you know, there's a lot of it that's sort of out there and been talked about, but there were a major set of reshoots to season one.
Oh no, I did not know that.
Yes. Okay. So, and that part of that, like episodes 1, 2 and what ended up being 4 were heavily revised, largely because the network or the, you know, everybody involved found it very important to establish the size and the scope of the world right away. And so that's why we wanted to open the way that we did. A bunch of things.
Which is fascinating, by the way, because you don't get the Philo vignette backstory until like episode 3.
Yeah, and that used to be episode 4. The mystery used to start in 1, and then we went out on 3 just trying to figure out how they knew each other, and then you went back to 4. But all of that changed in order to really give you the grand scale of the show and the grand ambition of the show, which I think was for the better. But to that point, and the reason I even brought that up is that Sophie originally appeared for the first time in 6 out of nowhere, and she was this cloistered away girl. But then when they did the reshoots, it was decided that, you know, we should bring her in earlier. And that scene that introduced her and her father was added. And I loved that scene when I saw it.
It's so good. There's so many juicy lines that Sophie says. And the actress that plays her is just so good.
Phenomenal.
She's so good. I think the line that stuck with me the most is something along the lines of when she says, isn't it curious that a woman can change the course of history with a flick of a pen or something along those lines?
Yeah.
Ugh, she said that and I just stood up and started clapping. I was like, that is a line. That is a line of dialogue right there.
She's got some good ones.
So were there any other massive like changes narratively that sort of happened in the writer's room? Like, I don't know, maybe aside from Sophie, like things that just came up and you're like, oh, that would be an interesting like extra layer or anything like that, that you can recall.
Well, I mean, there were tons of things. I don't know how many I'm allowed to say. Philo wasn't originally half Fae. That was something that was come to over time because it made it all so much more personal for him. And it became where he was the personification of the dilemma that was going on in the city and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And it just deepened things so much and it brought him closer to Vignette and it made it less something that we'd seen before. And I think that was probably the biggest thing that came out of the room that hadn't been. And I believe that was, I mean, it was a brainstorm between Renee and Travis, but it happened, you know, halfway through our first season writer's room.
Oh, wow. Okay. And it just adds so much more to the mythos, I think. And then that those scenes in the library in the flashback episode, like they carry so much more weight once you find out that he's half Fae.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then that moment at the end of the season where he's like, I am a Critch. And he walks in and you're just like, yes. Yeah. I literally, in that moment, I looked over to my dad and I was like, this is the Holocaust, like all over again. Like, this is what it is. It's insane. And they're doing this in a fantasy show. And this makes me so happy because this is exactly why I love the fantasy genre so much. And I wrote, and see, that's the funny thing. This is what I wrote on Twitter. And then like the Carnival Row writers account started commenting more and like retweeting and liking. And once I saw all that activity, I was like, okay, I might as well just throw it out there. Do any of you people want to be on my podcast? And here we are.
Yeah. I mean, the person who runs our writers room account is awesome. She's great. She's like on it. And she's who tossed you my way.
Well, I mean, I owe her so much because I literally ran around my room like 3 or 4 times when you were like, DM me. And I was like, I was like, this is how social media should function. Like, this is it.
So cool when you said you were in Lebanon. I was like, what? All right, cool. Let's do this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I lived in the US for 13 years, hence the English, but I moved back with my family almost 8 years ago. We moved back to Lebanon. And so what I do here is I have the podcast and then I write film reviews for a local newspaper and I teach at 2 local universities. One of the courses teaching being screenwriting, actually. So
cool.
Yeah. Okay. So back to Carnival Row. Cause I do want to talk a lot as much as I can about the show. You know, since you said that you kind of knew certain things going into the show, was the finale established early on or was this something that was like discovery written-esque?
It came up in the writer's room, but I think one thing that we did feel sort of new or like discussed at length. A lot of the writer's room is discussion, right? It's a lot of philosophical discussion. It's like, what would happen? And the way we would talk about it in the beginning is that we're starting with a center right government and then a series of events happen and you think it's already pretty bad and it only gets worse. So like we knew it was going to get worse. I feel like, and again, I'm reaching back 3 years, but I feel like we didn't necessarily know that there was, you know, a literal wall going to go up at the end, but maybe we did. Let me think on that for a second. Did we? We knew it was going to get ugly. It might have been like boots on the ground. It might have gone a little bit further, but yeah, like we knew it was going to be worse at the end than it was at the beginning. Let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, it's normally how things go on TV shows.
Well, but you know, that you would want certain things to be triumphant and that in fact that they wouldn't. And I think that there's two things that I want to say about that. One is that a lot of people bring up, oh, well, it's the current political climate in America and you're just imitating like some of the naysayers I've heard say that, like, oh, this is just a, you know, left-wing political commentary. The truth is, like I said, Trav wrote this script in the early 2000s and it's much more about imperialism and racism and just the other being other than it is anything that's specifically going on in America. But I'd be lying if I didn't say the day after the 2016 election, if we didn't all walk in the room and go, oh, well, we all live on Carnival Row now. So
it's funny because, but this is the thing though. So, okay. So like 2016 in the US, you guys had, you know, Trump and all the, you know, everything that's been going on in the US. I don't want to get into politics because I just rather not, but, us being in Lebanon, it's for me as well, it was a very, it resonated a lot because like in Lebanon, we not only have Syrian refugees, but we have a Palestinian camp and we have, you know, homeless people on the street and we have like, and so, and our government isn't, and I would love to say that our government was right or left or center right or center left, but it's so corrupt that you have no idea what they are anymore.
Right.
Which makes the show resonate with me even more because you're like, oh my God, this is chaos. Like this is, it's fear mongering, it's chaos.
Well, that's it. I think you make a good point, because that's exactly right. And that's what I would say to the people, that it's a direct, you know, a direct commentary on what's going on now. No, it's really not. It's a direct commentary on the state of the world as it's always been. Like, these situations have always gone on. There are always differences between people that are used to pit them against each other. And
exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's really interesting that, sometimes it's funny how sometimes like art comes out, or a piece of work or comes out, a piece of artwork, and it's just the right time for it to do so. And honestly, like, this is Carnival Row's moment. Like, it really is. And I really hope more people watch it and get involved, because, you know, as I begged Amazon on Twitter, I really hope there's more than a season two.
Yeah, but me too. Certainly, yeah. Good for me. And also, I'm so far deep in this thing now that, like, I think about them, you know what I mean? And like, so, and I think, you know,
yeah, I mean, of course,
As you know, as we spoke on briefly before we hopped on the podcast, like, I just wrote a prequel book. So
yeah, I was going to get into that, actually. So we might as well jump into that now. So you wrote the prequel book. It comes out this month?
It comes out October 4th.
And October 4th. Okay.
October 4th. And it's from the point of view of Tourmaline. And it takes place between 12 years and 7 years before the show starts. And
I don't mean to cut you off, but just to clarify the timeline. So it's post what happened in, why am I blanking on the names?
No. It's before the war hits. It's before the war comes to Tirnanoq, and then it chronicles her escape from Tirnanoq. You know, it catches up in episode 103. Remember when she shows up at the Mimas area?
Yeah, exactly.
It tells the 2 months before that, and then also five years before that, when she and Vignette met. So it's her and Vignette's story. And then her escape from Tirnanoq, and how those things kind of come together. But in doing that, like, I wasn't actually even trying to plug the book. What I was saying was I spent so much time, like, getting in her head, writing a novel from her point of view, that, like, that one of the reasons that I hope this thing goes on for as long as it possibly can is that I just now know it all so intimately, and with every step I take. And I'm the only one that's left from season one other than Travis. So it's become really important to me too. And so it's really nice for me to hear you responding to it and to see people responding to it. I've been interacting with people on Twitter. It's been fun.
So may I ask, you know, like, does this normally happen in writers' rooms where it's like there's a big shuffle from season to season?
Sometimes. It depends on what happens. You know, we got our executive producer left and we got a new one.
Okay.
And to be fair, I think that our new executive producer was very, very big on having a diverse writer's room, especially on a show that's about immigration and race and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And our initial writer had been overwhelmingly white. And so he sought to mix it up.
Okay.
Sought to mix it up.
Do they want a Lebanese one? Because I'd hop on a plane tomorrow.
Right? Well, I'll tell you what. You lived in America, so you know how it is in America. My heritage is Turkish.
Oh, that's so cool.
I'm getting people from that area. Somebody from Lebanon wants to talk to me. All right. Hey, Grandma.
That's awesome. Okay, so all right. So the book comes out October 4th. I mean, it will be available on Amazon, I'm guessing.
Amazon Audible. Yeah, it's an Audible book. And it's read by Carla Chrome, who plays Tourmaline.
Oh, okay.
So it's an audio book. It's part of Amazon's whole thing. So it's sort of like an
that's
old
interesting.
Radio
so it's thing. Not actually like a book. So it is a book, but it's releasing just as an audio book?
Yes, I don't know. I've had a lot of people ask me if it's actually going to be available as like a written book. And I'm not sure about the answer to that. I have to find out. I actually promised a couple of people on social media I would find out.
That's but actually very stands, interesting, though. It's, like, it's very immersive in what Amazon is doing.
Yes. And I'm sure, I mean, I've listened to some of their other productions before. So there'll be different, you know, sound effects. It'll really, like I said, it'll feel like a radio play. That's what the Audibles feel like. Oh, and it's so done by Carla Chrome, who plays Tourmaline.
Oh, that's so cool. More work for the actress. This is awesome.
Oh, yeah. And she's so good.
Oh, she's very, very good. That last, I mean, you know, okay, going back to spoiler territory, but that last moment where she's saying goodbye to Vignette and she's like, I'm fine. I love you. Go, you know, you're just looking at her and you're like, oh, Tourmaline. I want to give you a hug.
Oh, yeah.
And that's also a very interesting and unconventional, like, love triangle, because it is and it isn't, which is very interesting. Like, it's, it has some of the same, let's say, variables or pieces of the formula, but it's not really a love triangle. Like, it's different. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. And that's something that I also appreciated, that it wasn't like this conventional love triangle where it's like, do I want to be with him or do I want to be with her? And it, you know, I almost feel like it's like she loves Tourmaline. We know she loves Tourmaline, but right now she's feeling more connected to Philo, and that's who she's going to be with. So it's not like this sense of betrayal and how dare you. It's more just, let's see where this goes, you know, like.
Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, look, another thing, and this is purely Travis, which I absolutely love. The fairies are all pansexual. Like, they don't have the hangups around sex that, like, our culture in America certainly does, or any of that sort of thing. So they're attracted to people. So, you know, Tourmaline and Vignette were a thing, you know, and it was a significant thing for both of them. And if you read the book, you'll see. But there's no animosity.
I love your indirect, like, listen to the book.
Well,
that's awesome.
It's good prep for season two, because there'll be more stuff there in season two. So I think knowing that backstory, if you are into the world or if you're somebody who likes to go deep, I think it will help inform your perspective on season two. But you're right. It's not a traditional love triangle in that nobody's vying for anything. Like, Tourmaline isn't trying to make a go at her or anything like that. It's been years since they were together. There's just a deep affection there, and she wants her to be happy. And Vignette is sort of finding her way, right? So, and Philo is a surprise. That's the other thing you have to take into account. Like, when she was coming to the Burg, she thought that Philo was dead. And if you look in the pilot, when the sailor tosses her the matchbook, he tosses her the matchbook for the Tetterby Hotel, which is basically telling her where her friend is.
So initially she was going to see Tourmaline and
then Philo is alive, and it just throws everything for a loop. And so that'll all be stuff that gets contended with later.
Yeah. And I love that wasn't necessarily like dragged, like it didn't drag. Mm-hmm. It just, like, it was in the first episode and we just like dove into it, and you know, the story just like picks up. And it's funny because I would say that the pacing of the show is a little like it's a slow burn, but at the same time so much is happening that you don't feel like it's a slow burn.
Yeah, I think that's
fair. Because there are so many different storylines moving at the same time.
Yes, and there were even more. Yeah, I like when it slows down a little bit, because my favorite moments, kind of what you were saying about Game of Thrones, right? My favorite moments are when you can sit in character, and when characters have a moment to reveal who they are in the smallest of ways.
Yes, 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 absolutely.
And so as long as it's moving, it's great. But then at certain times, you know, we pick up the pace and it goes. I mean, I like the pacing of one, because it is a mix of that. It is... it gives you the character moments, but also the plot is always moving. And I think there's a card turn in every episode. Like, that's what I was realizing as I watched it last night. Like, okay, you're focused on who is his mom, and then you're focused on who is his dad, and then you're focused on, like, you have a new thing to focus on at the end of each one, especially once it gets rolling, like once you come back from Tiernanoc and it really gets rolling.
One of, and it's funny because we were just talking about Game of Thrones. One of the actors on your show used to be on Game of Thrones.
Yes.
And she is actually someone that I respect a lot, because I think she's a great actress. Indira Varma. Yes. Was it always the case that she wasn't gonna make it?
Once we knew that I think we knew she was the baddie from the get-go. I'm trying to remember, and I do recall that it was always her. Yeah, I think that was always the case. It was not always the case.
That's so sad, because she's such a great actress.
Like, yeah, she's phenomenal. I don't think it was always the case, though, that Breakspeare was going to die. In all honesty, like the way that the room was already broken. Like originally, and this speaks to what I was saying earlier about regime change and all the different ways that a show can be delayed or go off the rails or any of that sort of stuff. When we were in the writer's room on season one, we were breaking 10 episodes and they were assigned up through six and I was writing six. And when the room broke, the room was over. We were going to have to figure out, we knew what was going to happen in six through 10 or in seven through 10, but they hadn't been assigned to a writer yet. It was just, we had broken the story. So I turned in my first draft and then I got a message back from Renee that it was really, really great, but he needed to talk to me. And I'm like, oh God, what's happening? And then the same day that I turned in six, they got the call from Amazon that we were going to be eight episodes instead of 10. So we needed to basically do a big rebreak of the back half.
Oh, that's so interesting. So technically there were supposed to be two more episodes.
Yes. And so at that point, a lot of things had to change because things were in play. And so that's what I mean about, like, I don't recall, like, I'm pretty sure that I don't think Breakspeare was dying originally, but I think Piety was, or at least, you know, like, so it's trying to recall, like, cause it all changed after the fact. And then
in my mind, the eight are so, like, it's so perfect and can, like, contain, like, I wonder what an extra 2 hours would have done for the show. Like, that's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think it works the way it is too. And I mean, that's it. Obviously you go back and you redesign it and you tighten things up. Like Vignette had, the Black Raven was a much bigger storyline before. And, you know, there were Milworthy the whole show originally opened with Milworthy's show, like a puppet show. So like there were things that were much bigger that are now culled out of it. So it's not necessarily that the plots that are there would have been so much bigger, although maybe there would have been a little bit more taken toward in the very last episode, because a lot happens in the very last episode regarding Philo and the mystery and Piety and all that stuff. So yeah, so it's more that there just would have been other storylines that were a little bit better. Quill originally had a fully fleshed out storyline. Like, I mean, like it originally opened like with him on the factory floor and this horrible thing happened and Breakspeare owned the factory that he worked in, where they didn't give a shit that this horrible thing happened. And so, you know, it's that stuff that got pulled out. So it just would have been, other storylines would have been fuller.
That's so interesting. Okay. So, let's kind of start, you know, I'm trying to think if there's anything else about season one that I want to talk about. I could talk about this for hours, but you know, we're not going to do that.
How creepy is Ezra?
Oh, okay. All right. So let's talk about Ezra. Ezra is very, very creepy. But see, this is the thing. So this actually goes into what I wanted to talk about, which is this, this thing where, again, like there were so many things that, I was afraid that we're going to head a certain direction. And then you guys were like, no, we're way smarter than this. And so, I loved that. So like one of the things was like with Tourmaline, cause we were talking about the love triangle. Like there were many moments where I was just like, oh no, don't do the jealous girl thing. Like, please don't do it. And then she doesn't. And I'm like, thank God, you know, like you didn't, you know, like, thank you for not going down that path. And, the other one was like Ezra. So that moment, that climactic moment between Imogen and Ezra and Mr. Agreus, that scene is so good. And I was afraid that one of them was going to die. And I was like, because it sets itself up this way. Yeah. And you're like, oh no, they're going to do it. Like, we're going to deal with another murder. And then it doesn't happen. And you're like, oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah, I love that whole storyline. I mean, like, you know, people talked about it being like, I've heard people say, oh, I know where that was going. And you said the same thing, like, you know, they're going to fall in love. And I think that's true, but I really have an appreciation for, I think it was handled really deftly. And I think the actors really sold it, you know, like left to lesser actors, that would have been a pat storyline. And it was just beautiful. Like they're a dream. Like when you hand somebody something that could be really great if you get somebody who's good, but could also go the way of being totally cheesy and stereotypical. And then they just deliver at that level.
So like my thing with like, almost like I would say predicting or like calling the whole love story thing. Mm-hmm. For me, it was never like an eye roll of, oh, it's going to be a love, yeah. You know, like they're going to fall in love. On the contrary, like I called it and I was like, I can't wait for that to happen because her entire world is going to change.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's where my prediction came from.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think it was a bad thing. I just meant like, you know, we've seen sort of like that story before. That's something that I also think is extraordinary about Travis. Again, not to like, I mean, it's just, you just have to give him so much credit for this. Is that he likes to subvert expectations. He likes to take a story that you think you've seen before and do something different that's more real with it. So
justifiably subverting expectations, because there are other showrunners that don't have a clue what they're doing. On another fantasy show that ended earlier this year.
Oh, God.
Sorry, I couldn't take a jab at them because it's true though. Like it's, you know, like there is subverting expectations and then there's, ooh, look at the cool thing we're doing. And it's like not one moment of Carnival Row felt like the latter. Like,
no.
It all felt.
It has to be satisfying.
Earned. Like exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, like, and to set things up and then dangle them out there and do nothing with them, even if you do something that may not be what the audience was expecting, and preferably it's not what they're expecting, but you have to address the threads that you hang out, you know? So mm-hmm. I'm with you.
Okay. So, is there anything you can sort of like vaguely tease about season two without getting yourself into trouble and losing your job? Cause I really don't want you to do that. But like, is there at least like thematically or just like certain things that we should look out for or whatnot?
Well, I think,
Is there a release date for season two?
No, yet? It's in pre-production and right now in Prague and in, Dubrovnik, I think.
Okay.
Cool. And yeah, I mean, we're going to see more of the world than we've seen before. We're going to see what happens with, Jonah and Sophie in power. I think we're going to see, a bit more of how the worlds impact each other. You know, what's happening at, Balefire Hall impacts what's happening on the row. You are going to have the ghetto situation where, you know, the Faye and the Pucks and everybody are all crammed into Carnival Row. And I think something that's interesting to think about, which gives away nothing, is just that initially, yes, Carnival Row was a predominantly Faye neighborhood, but there were Faye living throughout the city in different places. And now all the different types of creatures are all going to be crammed into this same little tiny radius. So there'll be some internal struggles there as well. I think you're going to see.
Would you say that season two is a little more politically driven? And politically, I don't mean like paralleling our world, but is it more focused on the political system within the world of Carnival Row?
Well, the impact it has, not necessarily like the politics themselves, although you do start to see more of like what happens when someone like Jonah, who has no idea what he's doing and basically just cares about himself, is in power and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, one thing I think is a lot of people would want to see, or I think there are some people that may be prone to see Sophie as like another little mini Piety, and she's anything but that. So,
She's way more dangerous in my opinion.
Yes, but also, less sort of classically evil too, right? Like much more complex.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's exactly why I think she's more dangerous, because she's not like a classic villain. She's got a lot of issues. Let's just like internal darkness that's inside of her where she feels entitled, and that never leads anybody down the right path.
Yes, they're two very entitled people for different reasons and two sort of wounded animals, you know, so it's interesting to see how that happens. Vignette and Philo, if you consider that they've only ever been together in really heightened circumstances, like their whole relationship was a few months in a war-torn country. It'll be, I think, interesting to see what their lives are like settling into a more domestic situation. But of course, things will never be dull on Carnival Row, so there'll always be, you know, a certain element of things going on. But you know, so it's not like they're settling into domestic bliss by any stretch of the imagination, but they are settling into a more normal relationship. And so we'll find out if they really have a relationship.
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to think of what else. And then...
will we find out more about, like, some of the mythos of the world? Because, like, in episode three, one of the things that I enjoyed most about episode three were those library scenes and looking into the history and like the mythos and almost like the more spiritual side of the world, I would also say. So will we see more of that within season two?
A little bit. It's not an emphasis, but I think there's always world building going on. And there's always, you know, a ton of like deeper digging. And I will say this, Philo is on a bit of a spiritual quest. And you know, he's a man with no home.
Well, I would think so after all the shocks that he's experienced.
Yeah, he's a man with no home, right? And now like do the Fae accept him? I mean, he looks like a human and he's walking around in the ghetto and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So you know, he has a lot of stuff to contend with and still that pull of like the life that he left behind. And I think you'll see some of that. And I think there's some nice surprises with some more ancillary characters. That will come back in ways that are true to character, but may not be what you expect. And, you know, there's some good stuff. It's really action packed. I will tell you that season two,
Well, it felt like it. It felt like it. Like the setup, you know what I mean? Like I remember the episode ends, the credits are rolling. I look over to my dad and I go, the show is just going to start in season two. Like, that is literally, we are now in the second act of the movie. Like, this is where shit is going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
Like, what we saw, if this was good, season two's, whoa. Like, that's what I literally told my dad. I was like, season one is nothing now because, like, the action is, this is where the craziness is going to happen.
There is. There's a set piece in every episode. Like, there's a big thing that happens in every episode.
Cool. As long as it doesn't focus too much on spectacle, I'm good. Like, I don't want that to happen at Carnival Row.
No, I feel the same way. I mean, look, like, they could have gone even slower for my personal taste because I just love the characters so much and I love seeing them. But there's something really exciting. And when, I mean, as I'm sure you know, this show has a massive budget. Like, you can just see it on the screen.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that Mark, our current showrunner, and Travis just decided, well, let's put that money to use. Like, let's do something really exciting in every episode. But we don't do it at the expense of character. It was important to make sure that they all still have arcs and drives and changes and go into places that, you know, they're all out of their comfort zones now. Imogen is way out of her comfort zone. So, we'll learn more about Agrayes too. Like that's a big point. We'll learn his backstory in season two.
Yeah, because he's I think in all of season one he's still the biggest question mark.
Yes, he is. Because how did he get there, and what is his story, and how was this possible, and what does he have
exactly?
To what is I love him. I mean, that David Jesse is just phenomenal. I was watching.
He's so good.
He's besides Sophie, he's also got a lot of great one-liners. So
yeah, for sure. The shade he drops people is
so
just amazing.
Serious, right?
It's so good. It's so good. Oh man. Okay, Stephanie, I'm so, so thankful that you took the time. I know you're sick and it's so early in LA right now, but I'm so, so thankful that you took the time to come on and do this with me because, you know, you're literally a highlight for Script to Screen because, aside from the Lebanese, filmmaker Nadine Lebeke, I don't think we've had someone like, you know, buzzworthy. And with Carnival Row being as awesome as it is, you're buzzworthy.
Oh, thank you. Well, listen, it's so
cool. So,
who likes the show?
Oh no, I mean it. I literally mean it. Like, I'm so happy that we got to do this.
My friend.
Hopefully, once season two is out, we'll do it again and we'll talk about season two.
Yeah,
because I would love to do that again. But maybe like talk more about story-wise and not just like general stuff. So thank you so much. Good.
Huh? I was just going to say, I never could have imagined the show taking off in the way that it has. So I've done a bunch of this stuff where I'm talking about. So now I'll be more prepared for season two.
Yeah. Normally I do this on the show. If people want to follow you on social media, where can they follow your work?
My Twitter is Bellepoque, BelleEpoque, as in like beautiful age. And that's probably the best place.
Okay, on Twitter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, awesome. Again, thank you so much for coming on. I wish you all the best with season two and your book release. Keep up the good work. Can't wait for season two. I hope you feel better and have a wonderful Sunday with your family.
You too.